Okay, so my man Al Pacino just wrote a book. It's called Sonny Boy, a Memoir. It's released in a couple weeks. We shall see how it is. He can get a little corny in interviews, but he's always very passionate at the very least. And I heard an interview he recently did on the New York Times podcast, and his old ass just recently had a kid with someone. He's joining that club of old actors that had kids late in life, including the Odd Couple's Tony Randall, a first-time father at 78, Robert De Niro, a seventh-time father, seven, holy shit, at age 79, and Clint Eastwood, who had his eighth kid, take that, Robert De Niro, at age 65. Clint Eastwood is like 150 years old or something, but he keeps on ticking, and if Clint Eastwood happens to die after I record this episode, I'm just going to give up. And hey, please check out Clint Eastwood's directorial debut from 1971, Play Misty for Me, where Clint plays a Bay Area disc jockey who meets and then gets stalked by an increasingly deranged fan played by Jessica Walter. It's thrilling, fun, and just a nifty movie. Plus, the song Misty is just great, written by Errol Gardner in 1954, supposedly while he was on a long flight looking at clouds and shit. Talk about a productive trip. Good work, my man. I once puked on myself midway through a flight from Los Angeles to New York City, but let's not get into that right now, okay? And here's a little of that song. It's way too hard to play on the guitar, but man, what a song. Check out the version by the previously mentioned Leslie Gore, or just the version by the legend herself, Ella Fitzgerald. Look at me, I'm as helpless as a kitten up a tree, and I feel like I'm clinging to a cloud I can't understand. I get misty just holding your hand. Oh, and when I was like a little teeny kid, we had a dog named Misty. It was like a cool-looking white dog, and what a great name. I tell you, my parents were a class act. Okay, so back to Al Pacino. So on the interview, the guy asked Pacino, like, what's a good movie he did that his little baby son should watch when he grows up? And I was expecting Al Pacino to say, you know, one of his classics, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, The Godfather, and he said, Jack and Jill. And I was like, Jack and Jill, which is a 2011 movie directed by the sometimes actor Dennis Dugan, starring Al Pacino as himself and Adam Sandler playing the twins, Jack and Jill. Jack is a commercial director. Jill is an annoying as hell chick, and she comes to visit during the holidays. Jack is trying to get Al Pacino to star in a Dunkin' Donuts commercial for a product called the Dunkachino. Pacino, Dunkachino, get it? Anyway, Jack and Jill run into Al Pacino at a L.A. Lakers game. He's also there with Johnny Depp. It's kind of a funny scene. And Al Pacino is instantly smitten with Jill. And she has, like, little interest, and the rest of the movie basically has Al Pacino trying to court her. The movie was terribly reviewed. It totally bombed. And recently, Al Pacino said he did the movie because he needed the money, which reminds me of the kind of terrible but kind of awesome Andrew Dice Clay joke. Little boy blue. He needed the money. Oh! And of course, we remember the sample of Andrew Dice Clay saying, oh, in the massive hit song Unbelievable by EMF in 1991. But I am telling you, Al Pacino is goddamn great in Jack and Jill. He's so committed. His performance is fairly restrained, though he's over the top when it's warranted. I mean, I laughed out loud several times, and I dare say it's one of my favorite Al Pacino performances ever. Certainly one of the best of the last 15 years, which isn't really saying a lot, honestly. But please watch the movie and tell me he's not amazing. Not really a spoiler, but he does end up doing the commercial, and after him and Adam Sandler, like, screen it for the first time, Al Pacino looks at Adam Sandler and says, burn this. This must never be seen by anyone. It's so good. And I'm not huge on Adam Sandler, but sometimes I'm just in the mood for something so stupid. I also watch the unrated version of You Don't Mess with the Zohan from 2008, again directed by Dennis Dugan. You've all probably seen that movie, but it's got a ton of funny shit in it, and Adam Sandler is great in it. A lot of it is extremely off-color. Adam Sandler plays an ex-Israeli intelligence agent who becomes a hairdresser in New York City, and then, like, after he cuts these old ladies' hair, he, like, goes up in the other room and fucks them. I mean, it's completely ridiculous. And he calls screwing doing the sticky. The movie has one of the songs I just grew up with and loved as a kid, Adam Ant's Strip from 1983. What a catchy, fun song. Here's a little bit of that. Just follow an ancient history. If I strip for you, will you strip for me? Don't freeze up, girl. You're looking quite a sight. Be generous. I want it all tonight. Ooh. And I recently rewatched the utterly amazing, kind of surreal, kind of existential animation short Duck Amuck from 1953, directed by the king of animation himself, Chuck Jones, and written by Michael Maltese. I wonder if he had a falcon. But it's with Daffy Duck. He's trapped in a short film, and at some point, the background disappears, and Daffy kind of looks at us and sees, like, whoever's in charge here? Where's the scenery? It gets increasingly weirder, playing with different scenarios and different sound effects. It's basically genius-level shit. It ends with, the camera pulling back from the animation table with Bugs Bunny there as the animator, and he kind of looks at us and says, ain't I a stinker? All right, well, I guess this is the part where I play my opening song.
You are my density. You are my density.
And briefly, back on Al Pacino, I always remember the scene in The Godfather when he goes to visit his father, Vito Corleone, played by Marlon Brando, after he has been shot, and the hospital is, like, deserted, and Al Pacino picks up the phone to call the family, and he tells the operator, get me a Long Beach 45620. And I was always like, damn, that's cool. And I was always, and then I was like, what the fuck does that mean? It was before my time, but up until the 1960s in most metropolitan areas, telephone numbers would start with the first two letters of the name of the area and then the five numbers. Way early on, I guess it was three letters and four numbers. I mean, how classic is that shit? The Hotel Pennsylvania phone number, yes, was PE65000 or Pennsylvania 65000. As the Glenn Miller song so memorably sang out, some of the other classic two-letter and one numbers were Butterfield 8, BU8, Gramercy 5, GR5, Algonquin 4, AL4, and the Plaza Hotel, PL9. I still try and make fun names out of phone numbers occasionally, and I read someone once figured out that the new number for the First Methodist Church in Hollywood could be spelled out as Goddamn on the phone, and that phone number has since been disconnected. And of course, John O'Hara wrote a novel named Butterfield 8, which was also a movie with Elizabeth Taylor and the kind of haunted-looking Lawrence Harvey from 1960. I always thought Lawrence Harvey kind of resembled the post-accident Montgomery Clift. And speaking of phone numbers in New York, Alan Bridge was an artist in New York City in the late 70s, and in 1980 he put up a bunch of flyers in New York City with a phone number where people could confess to their sins, and he called it the Apology Line. He was Mr. Apology. And it was connected to an answering machine in his West Chelsea loft. People were encouraged not to identify themselves and call from a payphone to prevent tracing. And call they did, confessions of violence, infidelity, theft. Alan would occasionally pick up an incoming call if someone sounded suicidal. This guy had started the line in the hopes of people calling in order to unload their sins and heal, but a lot of people that called had no remorse, or worse, they were bragging about their sins. All of this eventually wore down Alan a bit, and he became isolated, and he eventually died after a jet ski hit him on Long Island. And this article ended with a friend of Alan's saying what she thought Alan would say to this jet skier that killed him. And she said Alan would tell him to apologize. He'd want the person to let go and not carry around guilt. Apologizing is a release of pain. So rest in peace, Mr. Apology. And let's speak of a form of apologizing known as confessing in the religious sense. And I try to be pretty honest in this podcast of my failings and defeats, but there are so many things that can just never be spoken about. Just certain impulses or weird shit, at least while my mom is alive anyway, okay? And back when I was a wee little lad, my parents had me briefly go to Catholic school classes at Christ the King Church in Northern California. I don't remember too much about it. I wasn't too into it. But I do remember this guy, Monsignor Wade, was there that literally always looked like he was 200 years old. And there exists a picture of me walking in church with my hands clasped together in front of my heart, making the goofiest face to my mom who was taking the picture. I was probably 7 at the time, so I've always been a wise ass, a smart aleck, a wise acre. And no one says wiseacre anymore. It's a weird fucking term. But anyway, I remember going into the bizarro confessional booth a few times. You go in there, the priest is shielded to you by a screen, and then you confess your sins. I was so young at the time, honestly. I just kind of made shit up to confess. I would just be like, bless me, Father, for I have sinned. I said the Lord's name in vain 5 times, more like 500. And I was nasty to my mom, 3 times, probably 50. And I had impure thoughts, 6 times, more like 600 times. Then the priest would say, okay, say Hail Mary 6 times. and say six Our Fathers, a.k.a. the Lord's Prayer. I never really got into religion. I appreciate my parents for giving me the opportunity, but it just wasn't my thing. And so many complete assholes that treat people like shit go to church. I've always figured I would try to be a good guy in real life. And at the end of the day, if there is a God and he's like, well, you can't get into heaven because you didn't go to church, well, I'd be like, okay, fuck it. Send me down to hell so I can party with Charlie Sheen and Rodney Dangerfield. And confessing is so weird. It's like the priest is a doctor or something and he writes you a prescription to absolve yourself. Say three Hail Marys and call me in the morning. And this got me thinking, what if I was to go to confession now? I would be like, let's see, it's been 35 years or so since my last confession. Let's see, well, I've said the Lord's name in vain. Well, and impure thoughts and acts. Well, you know what, Father, what time does your shift end? Because we're going to be in here for a little while. And I have nothing against religious people, man. Whatever works for you, go for it. But ultimately, it comes down to, are you a decent person? Do you try and do the right thing? Do you help people out? That's all that really matters in the end. And usually the people that are so hardcore and like vocal about religion are the ones who are fucking other people over and cheating and lying and shit anyway. Okay, end of sermon, but let me pass around the little collection plate now for donations. Don't be stingy, motherfuckers. I was looking in the mirror the other day, never a wise move, and I was like, Jesus, when did I start looking like the film director Abel Ferrara? I mean, not completely, but I'm looking a little haggard, so let's talk briefly on Abel Ferrara. He's kind of a New York City legend, a bit of a drug addict back in the day, legitimately interesting, but honestly, his movies, they're kind of sucky, aside from a few pretty damn good ones. He played the title killer in his movie The Driller Killer from 1979. It's low-budget, schlocky, but there's a legit grimy feel to it. Miss 45 from 1981 was a little bit better. It starred the pretty interesting Zoe Lund. She was an actress and musician, a talented girl. The movie's, you know, it's a bit of a mess, but she was a striking personality, and she's the highlight of the film. Like many in the Abel Ferrara scene, she got heavily into drugs. She kind of removed herself from Abel Ferrara, but she did reunite with him on the 1992 version of Bad Lieutenant, which she co-wrote and played a small role in. Again, Bad Lieutenant starring Harvey Keitel, it's pretty decent, but it's kind of a pretentious mess that thinks it's deeper than it really is. Plus, is it ever really necessary to see Harvey Keitel's penis? The answer to that, dear listener, is no. But don't get me wrong, Bad Lieutenant is definitely worth watching in one of Abel Ferrara's better movies. The Werner Herzog remake with Nicolas Cage is pretty weird and fun, too. But yeah, Zoe Lund was a truly hardcore heroin user. The musician Richard Hell, no stranger to drug use, said, Zoe didn't just love heroin, she believed in it. She later swapped her long-term heroin use for cocaine, and she died in Paris in 1997 at the young age of 37. A tragic figure, no doubt. Dying at 37 is not normal, and no one will ever convince me that hardcore drug addicts are happy. Of course, they may be in bliss at certain times, but it's no way to live, and you always become a shell of yourself if you do it long enough. Now, Fear City from 1984 is kind of a fun thriller where strippers in Manhattan are being killed. It's got Tom Berenger and Billy Dee Williams. Again, it's sleazy as hell. It's kind of a noir with a lot of boobs and violence. Melanie Griffith puts in kind of a lousy performance. Go watch Brian De Palma's Body Double for a really well-done thriller with Melanie Griffith. But again, there is a seedy appeal to this movie. It's a little bit like what the recent Ty West movie Maxine was trying to achieve. And I know people love King of New York from 1990 with the great Christopher Walken. Maybe you love it too. I didn't, so I don't know. Fuck it. And I think part of the reason I don't love King of New York is that all the people I've met that really love the movie are usually people I don't like. So maybe it's my problem. Now, 1995's The Addiction, directed by Abel Ferrara, with the amazing Lily Taylor, Christopher Walken again, and Annabella Sciorra, is about a grad student who gets bit by a vampire and then she becomes one. This movie was shot in black and white. It looks great. It's classier than Abel Ferrara's usually work. And it's just kind of a cult film. It's totally worth watching. Dangerous Game from 1993 stars Madonna, Harvey Keitel, and James Russo, who I always kind of liked. Keitel plays a film director who's making a film with Madonna. He's sleeping with her, and James Russo is the lead actor. She's also sleeping with him. It's about drugs, alcohol, promiscuity. It's pretentiously written. Madonna sucks in it. I mean, it's professionally done. I saw this in the goddamn theater, believe it or not, and I remember kind of like not hating it, but I certainly wasn't bored. James Russo overacts his ass off, and I will never forget this scene where he's like talking about doing coke and sleeping with hookers, and he's kind of like, I need these things. I need these things, kind of reminiscent of Jake LaMotta. Abel Ferrara recently did a religious film called Padre Pio in 2022 with Shia LaBeouf, but I refuse to watch it. It looks boring as shit, and I can't stand Shia. My personal favorite, which I mentioned before, is the more mainstream Body Snatchers from 1993 with Meg Tilly, the knockout Gabriel Anwar from Son of a Woman fame, and a likable Billy Worth. It's a paranoid, lean sci-fi thriller set on an army base. Forrest Whitaker has a great part as a guy who's afraid to fall asleep and he's just popping amphetamines to stay awake. It's just a pro job, and the idea of Body Snatchers, previously filmed in 1954 by Don Siegel and 1978 by Philip Kaufman, is just a killer concept. These visitors from outer space destroy a person and create a perfect replica of the person that was devoured. The new pod person looks and sounds like the person, but you know something is off. It's a terrifying, sad, and just solid piece of work, so give it a look sometime. It's worth it, I swear, cross my heart, hope to die. And I'm not really looking like Abel Ferrara per se, but I do look kind of wrecked some mornings after being an idiot the night before. And it's always tricky to tell someone that they looked like somebody. I only tell people like that when I consider it, you know, someone flattering. It's not like, hey, you look like Chris Farley right before he died or something. And I've heard that I look like some random people over the years. Somebody once said I resembled the actor Noah Wiley, famously from the TV show ER. I was like, okay, not really, but hell, I'll take that. Somebody once said I look like John Lennon, and I was like, I don't really see that, but thank you very much. Another person said I resembled Bono from U2, and I told him to immediately make an appointment with the eye doctor. And the one that stings the most, possibly because there was a hint of truth, was someone said I kind of look like Steve Buscemi. Yes, the kind of bug-eyed but still undeniably cool and charismatic dude from Reservoir Dogs, the Quentin Tarantino film where Buscemi famously was named Mr. Pink by the organizer of the heist, Joe, played by the legendary and massively imposing Hollywood legend Lawrence Tierney. Buscemi's character hated the name. He's like, why am I Mr. Pink? And he bitches at Harvey Keitel, whose name Mr. White. Keitel says, who cares what your name is? And Buscemi says, well, yeah, that's easy for you to say. You're Mr. White. You have a cool-sounding name. And I do like Reservoir Dogs, and get this, Reservoir Dogs is an hour and 39 minutes. Again, Tarantino just started to, like, self-indulge himself after Reservoir Dogs, although Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown are undeniably good. Briefly, back to Lawrence Tierney. What a tough guy, man. He played the title character John Dillinger in 1945's Dillinger. And supposedly, after being shot by federal agents after fleeing a movie theater, his last words were, tell Billy for me. Bye-bye, Blackbird. And Billy Frenchette was John Dillinger's girlfriend. Back to Steve Buscemi, he had an impressive directorial debut with the 1996 comedy drama Tree's Lounge about Steve Buscemi as an unemployed alcoholic. It's well written and well acted, sad, and it's got a great performance by Steve Buscemi and Chloe Savini. But anyway, be careful who you tell people they look like, okay? And I was in the grocery store a while back, and someone said I look like the skateboarder Tony Hawk. And I was like, okay, hey, he's pretty fucking cool. And as I had mentioned, I was the worst skateboarder of all time. I had a pretty cool Uncle Wiggly skateboard and tracker trucks, and I subscribed to Thrasher magazine. But I was the wimpiest, worst skateboarder ever. And I remember Thrasher magazine was just like the messiest magazine. After you looked at it, your hands would be almost totally black from the newsprint. But back to Tony Hawk, I saw him on a recent commercial hawking, like how I did that, coenzyme Q10 supplements, and he kind of looked not so great. So I was like, did that person think I look like the younger, cooler Tony Hawk or the more ravaged version? But still, he does seem like a cool dude. And anyone that has anything to do with supplements, I consider a personal friend of mine. And yes, I take coenzyme Q10, actually the ubiquinol version. One of these days, I'll do an episode on my supplement problem. And I love researching stuff. And I can safely say that no one in the entire world takes the entire insane regimen I do, like the same brands and stuff. And I add in weird shit here and there, some injectable peptides and whatnot. And I'm not bragging by any means. My supplement problem is somewhat insane. But hey, what can I do? And I remember back in the 1990s, the FDA was talking about tightening the regulation of supplements. And reportedly, more people wrote to Congress about the proposal than about the Vietnam War. And something like 75% of the United States adults take supplements, so you don't want to fuck around with that many people. And there was actually a hilarious TV advertisement around 1993 where Mel Gibson is in his home, and he's grabbing a bottle in his kitchen, and a SWAT team breaks into his house, and he holds his hands up, and he's like, hey, guys, you know it's only vitamins. Vitamin C, you know? Like in oranges. Supplement lobbyists eventually got the 1994 Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act passed, which effectively stripped the FDA of its regulating powers, which also freed up people like me to spend a shitload of money on ridiculous, possibly helpful, and possibly useless supplements. But hey, that's America, right? We have the freedom to spend our money as foolishly as we want, and we certainly succeed at that. And I remember the comedy magician duo Penn and Teller, well, actually Penn, said that whenever Penn and Teller would go to movies and the movie would somehow ridiculously or appropriately work in the title of the movie during the movie, they would stand up and clap. I usually try not to mention the title of these episodes during the episodes, but it varies. A couple of great examples of a good use of this technique is the ending of The Dark Knight, where Gary Oldman says in the final shot, "He's a silent guardian, a watchful protector, a dark knight." Another perfect example is where Doc Brown tells Marty in Back to the Future, "Next Saturday night, we're sending you back to the future." And another appropriately well-done line at the end of a film is The Breakfast Club, where the line is, "Does that answer your question? Sincerely, The Breakfast Club." A kind of cornier, awkward use is in the movie Face Off, where the character says, "I'd like to take his face off." And this one kind of takes the cake for the RoboCop sequel, RoboCop 2. A character says, "Ladies and gentlemen, I give you RoboCop 2. And just one of the utter classic ending lines of all time is from 1974's Chinatown. "Forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown," which I mention every five episodes or so. And I came across the most random sci-fi movie at my mom's the other day, 1985's Warning Sign, with Sam Waterston, Kathleen Quinlan, the man Yaphet Kotto, and a pretty great Jeffrey DeMunn, who kind of reminds me of James B. Sicking, who was on Hill Street Blues. Mentioning Hill Street Blues 2 weeks in a row, who does that? But yeah, I try to dig up the weirdest movies at my mom's. Sometimes they're good, sometimes bad, sometimes enjoyably bad. But this one is a serious under-the-radar sleeper. It's kind of a sci-fi horror thing where some kind of biological virus is let loose in a rural weapons lab. Kathleen Quinlan is the timid security guard stuck inside, and Sam Waterston is her sheriff boyfriend. The government gets involved, headed by Yaphet Kotto. And Sam Waterston teams up with this kind of washed-up alcoholic scientist who used to work at the lab, humorously and well-played by Jeffrey DeMunn. The people in the lab become kind of zombie-like creatures. It's really enjoyable. It's got some humor. It's cheesy, but totally worth watching. It's also got G.W. Bailey, who famously was the dickhead lieutenant in the Police Academy movies, and it's also got Rick Rossovich, the kind of hunk dude who was in the Cyrano de Bergerac-derived 1987 film Roxanne, a classic comedy with a great Steve Martin and Daryl Hannah as Roxanne. Roxanne is directed by Fred Schapigi, a pretty talented Australian film director. But anyway, check out Warning Sign. It's a guaranteed good time, I promise. Let's wind this one down here. As I have often said, I sometimes view my life as if it is a movie or a story. And obviously, I'm the main character. And I was taking stock of myself the other day, and I was kind of like, okay, I'm a bit past middle age, a bit of a loner, ex-editor, ex-actor turned psych nurse. I've struggled with some substances in the past, continue to struggle with some things at times. I've had some girlfriends, but generally I'm on my own. I'm a bit cynical, but fundamentally I'm a decent guy. And I was like, shit, I kind of sound like a film noir character. And I was like, how much of my story just happened and how much of it did I kind of consciously create or write along the way? I mean, some of the seedier Brian De Palma, Paul Schrader aspects of my life, I definitely chose on my own. And, you know, sometimes I've decided not to settle for certain things at times here and there, realizing that I may end up alone in the end. But hey, I hopefully never let myself down. And I know I never knowingly hurt others. And so, hey, take a look at yourself and ask yourself, what kind of movie has your life been? Or is it going to be a comedy, a drama, a dramedy, a horror film at times, a romance, a tragedy? I mean, life should be all of that shit. And who knows, if I am a film noir character, maybe there's a femme fatale waiting around the corner. Change is a good thing. It keeps things interesting. Who knows what's going to happen? As Scarlett O'Hara said in Gone with the Wind, after all, tomorrow is another day.